You're listening to a 3CR podcast of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia.
Radio MMT respectfully acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land from which we are broadcasting, the Wurundjeri people, and we are broadcasting to the Kulin nations. Our focus is economics, that is, how stuff is produced and distributed. We recognise that for many tens of thousands of years, First Nations people's connection to country successfully embodied the world's oldest continuous economy, which was catastrophically disrupted by genocide and displacement. We acknowledge that we have much to learn to reshape our current extractive and exploitive system to achieve sustainable prosperity for everyone.
Radio MMT. Economics for the rest of us with Anne
and Kev.
Radio MMT.
Looking at the world through the lens of modern monetary theory.
Radio MMT.
Macroeconomics for a well-being economy.
Macroeconomics? Like, isn't that incredibly boring?
No, Kevin, it's incredibly interesting. It's all about who gets what and why.
Who gets what and why? Okay, I'm in.
Radio MMT at gmail.com.
Incredibly interesting macroeconomics for the rest of us. Welcome to Radio MMT. How are you this week, Anne?
Hello, Kevin. Yes, I was feeling a bit sleepy before we walked in, and then something about putting on a headphone and sitting in front of a mic, it wakes you up again.
It does indeed.
And hello to our lovely listener. You know, our lovely listeners have been very good to us lately.
Yes, so we're still in what's known as Radiothon for 3CR, and we've had some very generous people donate to Radio MMT, but to the station more importantly, and I want to reiterate this. When you're supporting Radio MMT, you're actually supporting the whole 3CR radio station, and it has many, many excellent programs, and so you get a lot more bang for your buck rather than just a single issue. This is true community radio, 50 years old. We have a small number of generous supporters. Really, if we're going to do this sustainably, to keep this going, we need a large amount of small donators. If we had 100 people that gave a small amount, that would be a lot more secure for us to survive and the radio station to survive.
Because, you're looking at diversity of donors.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of really generous people here. I mean, we're not going to go through amounts. The people who have been generous know who they are, and that's amazing. But I'm just going to quickly run through the list of people who have supported this show. There's Fred, Graham,
Mark, Misha, Victor, Gab, Glenn, Lou, Jack, Graham, Kent, Maliki, Shay, Andrew, Lucy, Bruce, James, David, Anonymous, Susan, Frederick and Michael.
Thank you very much. I'd like to spend about four times the amount of time reading out this list. And if you're listening to the podcast in the future, $5, $10, $20, that would really help enormously. That would really share the light a bit
more. No corporate money, no government money. Yep. It is literally you who are keeping the lights on here.
Yeah, so kick in whatever you can and join the
party. It's a good feeling when you do it, so try it out.
Yeah, yeah.
What I noticed about some of these people, Kevin, is that they are in Victoria, and I suspect a lot of them are in Melbourne, and so they could easily come along to pub night.
Oh, yes, and pub night's tonight, isn't it? Yeah. And it's a really good way to discuss macroeconomics and MMT and the rest of it over a beer at the end of the week. Nice way to wind down for the week. And
it's a fun way to have the nerdy conversation you always wanted to have, but nobody will put up with you. We'll put up with it.
Yeah. Hey, what have we got on the show for this week, Anne?
Well, this week I was thinking, Kevin, about how the world is full of dangerous ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Ideas like that men are superior to women, for example, or that we don't need to look after the environment because technology will save us.
Yep.
So what 3CR does, I think, is it acts as a bulwark against these dangerous ideas and offers some really good ideas instead. And so just to prove that this is what your money is going towards today, I thought we would expose a particularly bad idea which has for centuries it has been destroying the lives of millions of people, and this vicious idea is that we need to keep a certain amount of the population unemployed.
Yeah.
And these days, you know, the bosses seem to be happy with about 5% unemployment, as we saw in the recent federal government budget here in Australia. So today we're going to hear from friend of the show, Dr. Victor Quirk. And we're in for a real treat, I think, because Victor will be telling us about the battles that have raged over getting control of the levers of the economy that allow the government to set the unemployment rate. And as Victor was saying, you know, what we're about to hear, it could just about be made into a movie. Today, I thought we would take another look at full employment, or at least the ongoing lack of full employment. Now, full employment might sound like a bit of a snooze, but it's actually the site of great drama and intense struggle, which has gone on not just for years, not just for decades, but for centuries. And one thing that might surprise people who are new to discussions of full employment is that despite the constant hand-wringing by politicians and pundits, we do know how to employ everyone who wants to work. In fact, we know how to end involuntary unemployment, and we know who can do this. In fact, there is a paper written by Mikhail Kolesky and published back in 1943, and this paper was titled Political Aspects of Full Employment. And the opening line in Kolesky's paper reads, "A solid majority of economists is now of the opinion that even in a capitalist system, full employment may be secured by a government spending program." That was written back in 1943. So we have known the solution to unemployment for at least 80 years. So that begs the question, why do we still have high rates of unemployment? And this is the question Kolesky set out to answer in his paper from 1943. And I can think of no better person to help us ponder this question about the sad and sorry history of employment rates under capitalism than labour market political sociologist Dr. Victor Quirk. Victor, welcome back to Radio MMT.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
It's a pleasure having you.
Can I just alert the listeners prior to Radio MMT that we had a show called Unemployed Workers Fight Back? If you go right back to the very beginning of that, Victor was the first person we interviewed.
He was our inaugural guest.
And it's taken a long time to get him back, but excellent to have you back again, Victor.
It's still my proudest boast.
It's a great thing to have on your resume, isn't it? Well, Victor, I'm going to jump back into our issue of the day here. I was wondering if we could start with the economist Mikhail Kolesky, who lived from 1899 to 1970. What else do we need to know about him?
He was a Polish economist who, in the 30s, with the rise of fascism in Europe, he sought refuge over in England and joined Keynes and other scholars at Cambridge, and he's generally believed to have been the significant influence on Keynes in his development of the general theory. That it was Michael Kolesky who explained the role that the government can play in the economy in boosting aggregate demand and thereby reducing unemployment. It's generally considered that it was Kolesky that explained that to Keynes.
He explained it to Keynes. I'm hoping Keynes explained it to a politician or two.
Keynes came out with his general theory in 1936. That was the basis on which the allied countries, when they embraced his economic theories, they used it to finance the Second World War.
Mm.
And it was then the basis for the preservation of full employment after the war in several countries, especially for our point of view, Australia.
Mm.
We maintained Keynesian aggregate demand as a way of managing the economy, and we did that up until the mid-70s. And as a consequence, the government's maintained unemployment under 2% for 30 years.
So what's the mechanism? You're talking about this aggregate demand. What's the mechanism or the ability that the government has to maintain full employment if it so desires?
Well, it had been argued during the 19th century and early 20th century that unemployment came about because there was insufficient demand in the economy. Purchasing power, if you like. that would be sufficient to keep industry humming along and everybody that wanted a job to have a job. But it requires enough people having money to go into shops to buy stuff and the shops to order things from factories and the factories to hire people to produce them and things like that. So Keynes said there's essentially three sectors. There's the private sector, the businesses and households. There's the government sector. And then there's the foreign sector. We sell stuff to people overseas. They sell stuff to us. So in the situation where there isn't enough demand for goods and services produced in our country, so people overseas aren't buying stuff off us, and businesses sense there's a fall in demand, they'll cut back on production, people will be laid off, they won't be going into shops to buy stuff. Businesses will sense a further slump in demand and things will sort of spiral down unless the government, the third sector, steps in and compensates for the fall in demand. So in a situation where there is insufficient demand in the economy to employ everyone, so unemployment's running at 6 or 7% or something like that, a government, if it wanted to, could increase the numbers of people it employs and or can buy goods and services from the private sector. Those people that are employed will go into shops and buy stuff. The private sector will have a sense that there's an increase in demand, so they'll order more stuff from the factories. The factories will lay on more workers to increase production, and the whole economy will move to full employment. So with a bit of tweaking, the government can put these signals, give these signals to the private sector, and it will amplify them. So if there's a fall in demand that the private sector sends, it will amplify that fall in demand by making cutbacks. But if there's a rise in demand, the private sector will amplify that, and there'll be an increase in output and production. And so it's a question of the government being able to spend just the right amount of money and employ the right amount of people to tweak the private sector into achieving full employment.
So from the MMT perspective, I guess we can say the federal government has the ability to do this because it's got the money, it's got the capacity to spend when it's looking like a slump or a recession.
Exactly.
So what you're saying is there needs to be a level of activity in the economy to keep things ticking over. And if the private sector can't meet that activity level, then the government needs to step in and fill the gap. And that was the big difference Keynes came up with. Would that be right?
Well, yeah, that, and there had been a pre-existing belief that if governments left the free market alone, it would naturally achieve this full equilibrium of full employment. The fact that it had never happened in history.
What's a bit of data?
Keynes was able to demonstrate that it's quite possible for an economy to settle into an equilibrium with quite high levels of unemployment, and that it actually required government intervention in terms of employing people and or spending money into the economy to bring it to an equilibrium of full employment.
You know, it is the darndest thing because here we have, say, the potential for a recession, which means that businesses aren't making as much profit or aren't making as many sales. And yet, in this article, Kolesky was saying that the captains of industry, they do not want full employment. Why on earth would a business not want to be making as much profit as it can?
When Kolesky wrote this article, he was probably the most prominent economist to make this point.
Mm.
But it had actually been often discussed and often argued by labour movements in Britain and Australia, who had been earlier arguing for methods of achieving full employment using expanded public sector job creation to give otherwise unemployed people work. And there were ferocious debates and arguments about this to prevent it from happening. And it goes to Kolesky's point, and that is that unemployment is not an accidental blemish on the system. It is a very specifically necessary part of the mechanism from the standpoint of employers, because their position as the boss really depends on the fear of the sack.
Mm.
That ultimately, even nice employers, there's an unstated fact that if you weren't to show the right amount of discipline in the workplace, you run the risk of losing your job. Now, if you lose your job in a situation of buoyant full employment, the consequence of that is pretty minimal. So back in the 60s in Australia, when we had under 2% unemployment, in 1966 it was something like 1% unemployment, people could lose their job in the morning and they'd have another one by the afternoon. And that was typical. I met, you know, older workers when I was working in the CS in the 80s. One of them told me about a job he had where in 1966 he would walk around the Melbourne Central Business District at lunchtime, tapping people on the shoulder and saying, "How much are you being paid in your current job? Okay, we'll offer you $5 a week more if you come and work for us." And that was their job, because work was so plentiful and workers were hard to get. And so the consequence of that is that the threat of the sack loses its bite.
Mm.
And over a sustained period of time, it has a cultural impact. And so in Australia, you know, work wasn't the be-all and end-all. People weren't sweating about hanging on to their job. Mm. And trade unionism was extremely high. So we had something like 50% of industry was unionised. And that was substantially because you had nothing to lose. And there was a very strong increase in the standard of living of working people through the 50s and 60s, largely because of the bargaining power of labour. And that was achieved because of the maintenance of full employment after the Second World War.
So the captains of industry won't like full employment, partly because it strengthens the union movement.
And just the position of workers vis-a-vis their employers.
You're listening to 3CR 855 AM on digital and on the internet. www.3cr.org.au.
You know, I was reading in this article with Kolesky that the employers were arguing that the problem of unemployment is properly solved by the market. And they like to argue this because then the corporations or the businesses can say to the government, well, you know, you need to make policies that favour us so that we can provide all these jobs.
Well, the if the government does not intervene in the labour market, and when circumstances are that the private sector businesses have a contraction, the consequence of that is people are thrown out of work. When there is unemployment, workers have less bargaining power, and so you can create a more cost-effective cost structure in the labour force through recessions. And if business has the capacity to control that, to create recessions, then that's a powerful device at their sleeve. And it also has the political threat to governments who might get the political backlash for a recession happening. So therefore, governments are required to make sure they look after the interests of business so that there isn't the risk of that happening. So business-friendly policies are made necessary where the business sector, the private sector, has the capacity to induce recessions.
So they really get a lever. It's an indirect way of writing policy, isn't it, that favours the business class.
Very powerful one.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was their concern, that if governments with full employment policies. So the debates about this were huge. So if you go back to the First World War, the soldiers went off to the First World War. They'd promised that they'd come back to a land fit for heroes. In Australia, under the Constitution, the Commonwealth government has all sorts of extra powers during wartime. As soon as the war finishes, they lose all those powers. And so their capacity to manage the economy, you know, regulate supply and all sorts of things. So immediately after the First World War, unemployment went up to like 10%. So the soldiers coming back from the First World War, particularly in Queensland, walked into very high levels of unemployment. This prompted politicians like Ted Theodore, who was the Premier of Queensland, to introduce full employment policy in Queensland. It was a very clever piece of legislation, had all sorts of elements, large-scale projects. He was going to build a steelworks in Bowen to rival that of BHP. BHP's was knocked up in 1915, so this is 1919. Queensland were going to have their own version of BHP.
Oh, where was the BHP one?
In Newcastle. So there was going to be other sorts of public sector job creation. He introduced an employer-paid unemployment insurance system.
Ooh.
And the legislation also included for businesses that had more than £10 million of turnover or something like that, they could be ordered to take on more workers. They could be ordered, you have to employ another 100 workers or another whatever. Anyway, the Queensland business community hit the panic button and there was this massive campaign to stop this legislation. And they sent a delegation over to England because Queensland government would have had to have borrowed the money from London.
Of course, they're not the currency issuer.
Yes, they're not the currency issuer. And Billy Hughes' government was hostile, like the Conservatives were in power federally. So they sent this delegation over to London to get the London financial houses to put a blockade on Queensland. And so Queensland had a financial blockade for 4 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, until 1924. And it was only lifted after, firstly, Theodore dropped his legislation and introduced a version of Winston Churchill's policy from before the First World War, which was to set up labour exchanges and introduce a contributory dole system where the worker pays a third, the employer pays a third, the government pays a third into a fund. And then if you're unemployed, you'd use up your money. And when it's gone, it's gone. And that was a system that was good for your upper class workers, you know, your engineers and people like that, that were rarely unemployed and had good levels of income. So this would be a good system for them. But for your classic poor, casualised worker, it didn't touch the sides in terms of solving the problem. So that was Churchill's technique for looking like the government was doing something to help the unemployed without actually taking away the fear of unemployment.
Mm. Devil's in the details on these employment policies.
Mm. Yeah, well, Churchill's often cited as having, you know, very progressive views back in those days because he came up with this policy, but it was actually, you know, more an example of his devious strategic cunning more than anything else. But Theodore ended up running up the white flag and adopted the same sort of policy in Queensland. Then he stepped down from Queensland politics and went into federal politics in 1927. And when the Scullin government fought the 1929 election, Theodore became the Treasurer of Australia. And it was Theodore that was Labor's treasurer when we faced the Depression.
Lucky for Australia, you would think.
Well, you would have thought, yeah. But the conservative side of politics were terrified at this because they knew he had form. And so they cooked up a scandal that sidelined him. On the night before he was to deliver the 1930 budget, so we're in the middle of the Depression, and they were able to sabotage his budget. He was accused of something that happened during his period in the Queensland government, something from 10 years earlier. He sat on the back benches waiting for them to bring a court case against him that never came.
So they chucked him out of the treasurer position.
Well, he stepped down and this guy Joe Lyons became the acting treasurer. Well, Joe Lyons was a Conservative former Premier of Tasmania, and at the same time he was giving secret briefings to the Conservatives. So they were meeting at J.B. Weir and Sons head office.
Wow, it's cloak and daggers.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It would make a great film, I reckon.
We call it the budget wars.
Very clandestine stuff. But he was leaking information about the cabinet to their opponents, because the problem that they had with that government, Scullin government, was that the Senate was controlled by the Conservatives. And Conservative industrialists ran the board of what passed as our central bank at the time, which was the Commonwealth Bank, a government-owned bank that was also acting sort of as the central bank. And so these industrialists were opposed to the reflating of the economy because they thought it was necessary to drive down the cost structure in Australia. So anyway, there was this massive battle for the Labor government of 1930 and 31 to reflate the economy, given that they had Ted Theodore as the treasurer. And he was a Keynesian economist before Keynes was.
Mm.
And looking back on what he was proposing the release of about £18 million of fiat currency. £6 million was for a minimum price wool scheme to prop up the farm sector. And £12 million was for public works, enough to employ 40,000 workers around Australia at the very depths of the Depression. And the Conservatives on the bank board and in the Senate and in the media, Rupert Murdoch's father being a major figure in this, Keith Murdoch, they all blocked it. Mm-hmm. And eventually Conservative Labor people crossed the floor and brought down the government.
Radio MMT.
Economics for the rest of us with Anne
and Kev
at 3CR Community Radio, Melbourne, Australia.
In that lead up, in the lead up to the Second World War from about 1938 onwards, the Conservative government started to spend on defence. And as a consequence, the public sector spending into the economy brought the economy to full employment.
Oops.
By 1942, they were operating at something like 1% unemployment. And this caused a lot of controversy. There were letters to editors and there were articles written where people said, hang on a minute, how come 10 years ago when the veterans of the previous war were going through that depression, how come you said there wasn't any money to be spent? And if we did spend the money, it would have caused hyperinflation, like what had happened in Weimar Germany.
Good question.
And how is it that now we can be operating at full employment? How is this possible now? And so they basically had to concede, the Conservatives and the bureaucrats and the bankers had to concede that, oh, yes, we got that wrong. And they said that now that Keynes, Lord Keynes has explained it to us in his general theory, but it happened because it was just doing what Theodore said they should do.
The public, I guess, was also understanding, were they?
They saw it happen. The country was operating at full employment and all of a sudden the government had this money. Where did this money come from? That's what they said. How come 10 years ago there was no money to be had and you said there wasn't any money and that if we did spend the money, it would cause a hyperinflation? Today, as soon as you want us to fight another war, here we are. We've got all the equipment, all the boots, all the supplies, whatever.
Half a million boots went slogging through hell and I was the kid with a drum.
The interesting part of that story too is that they set up this thing called the Allied Works Council in 1942 to build massive infrastructure in Australia. They had to build ports and airfields and things so that the Americans could use Australia like a
springboard, yeah.
And they built all this infrastructure, and the person that Curtin put in charge of managing the whole process was Ted Theodore. Once the Allied Works Council had done its thing, and Curtin made the announcement in 1944 that with the completion of these works, I can now declare to the Australian people that the Japanese cannot take this country, you know, which is a pretty substantial thing. And that's Theodore basically pulled that one off. He goes in to see Curtin, for Curtin says, will you run this Allied Works Council? And he says, all right, I'll get stuck into it. So he starts to walk out the door, and Curtin says, hang on a minute, we haven't talked about, you know, what your pay is going to be. And he said, I don't want to be paid, you know, because he was actually quite wealthy because he's bloody discovered gold and all sorts of things. You know, he was like a mineral prospector as one of his hobbies.
And yet he understood the power of fiat currency as well.
Oh, absolutely. Again, I went through his papers during my research days, and here was this booklet that was reprinting a lecture that had been given for some engineering conference in England. So this is like 1916, like during the course of the First World War, where the person was saying, it's an extraordinary thing. We would have said that 10% of the population couldn't be employed because they lacked the skills and whatever. And here we see ourselves working at 1% unemployment, and plus we've also got more exports than we've ever had in the history of this country, because they were selling all the armaments to all the other countries, of course. And Ted had highlighted this with a pencil and was writing notes and wrote it on the front cover of it, you know, 1% unemployment, whereas we always said that these people didn't have the skills. So he's got the quote written on the front. So that's the thing about a lot of this stuff, is it was all understood.
Mm.
It wasn't some revelation that came from Keynes. That just practical people that were involved in managing labour markets and economies, particularly in Australia. Bill had an interesting statistic. This is Bill Mitchell.
One of the founders of modern monetary theory.
Yep. He had a very interesting statistic that by like 1943 or something, 60% of the workforce in heavy industry in Australia, something like 18 months before, they weren't even in the labour force. So there's all the women that were in all the armaments factories that previously hadn't been employed and making the uniforms and all that sort of gear. Because what happened was that we manufactured a lot of that stuff here, and that was one of the reasons why we also had full employment.
He sounds like an interesting guy, this Ted Theodore.
Theodore had also hooked up with Frank Packer, Kerry Packer's father, and they formed Australian Consolidated Press with Theodore as the general manager, and they developed the Australian Women's Weekly, which became the biggest publishing cash cow in Australian history. That was Ted Theodore.
I've used so many of their recipes.
So, yeah, it's a very interesting character. Lots to be said.
Interesting how these understandings come and go, both with the policymakers. It gets discovered and forgotten. With the public, it gets discovered and forgotten. So these days, if you tell people, oh, we could hit full employment, you know, you'll have people out of the Reserve Bank of Australia and other places saying, oh, no, we've got to keep it at 4% or whatever it is.
Well, that is full employment to them.
Mm.
They've just redefined what full employment is.
It's another little
tweak. This was in 1949 election. Australia had had less than 2% unemployment for 4 years after the war. And by this stage, the Australian public were fully comprehending of how it came about. They'd lived through the Depression. They had the war. They knew it was the government spending into the economy, the public sector employment, because there was masses of public sector jobs on the railways, the border works down here in Melbourne, the State Electricity Commission, the Gas and Fuel Corporation, They employed masses of tradespeople. All the local councils had heaps of jobs, council workers. And because of that, unemployment was sitting under 2%. And it was a stated government policy. This was the 1945 white paper on full employment that the Curtin government put out. This was what it was about, saying we're going to put this amount of spending into the economy to maintain the same levels of unemployment that we've experienced during the war.
What was the public discourse on the fear of government debt back in those days? I mean, these days it's all about, you know, how are you going to justify the spending? And yet these government projects costing a fortune during the war and then after the war. What was the narrative on deficits and debt?
Conservatives did raise that bogey, and Curtin just came out and said that in wartime we had all the money that we needed to fight the war, and in peacetime we'll have the same sources of money to maintain full employment.
And the public, how did they receive that? It just doesn't sound like it was much of an issue.
Well, the people were grateful for the full employment. They realised that their lives were better. I mean, still, you know, there was still poverty, but it was not the Depression. There was massive public housing after the war. See, the big part of their plan was to build 50,000 houses after the war as a way of bringing the soldiers back from overseas, making sure that there were plenty of jobs for people to do, in shutting down the armaments factories and all the sort of wartime industries. All those workers had to go somewhere, so they had this idea of this massive public housing project. Well, that meant that the average young family could start off their lives in public housing. We think of public housing as something for the poorest and most marginal members of the community, but it was once quite a normal thing for the average people to start their families off in public housing. They'd stay there for 5 or 6 years, get enough money together to put down a deposit, and then they'd buy a house. And because there was this massive investment in public housing, that means that there were masses of apprentices being trained, so there was heaps of tradespeople. And as a consequence, there was generally a high level of house building and home ownership. And we had one of the highest levels of home ownership in the world. And this was because of the post-war public housing program.
And so you can see unemployment back in those days as something that government recognised that it had pretty much full control over. It could create full employment if it wanted to, or it could let it go if it wanted to. But these days we hear of unemployment and it just sounds like it's a natural consequence of the market, and it's not something that can be helped. And if unemployment rises, it's probably their fault for not being skilled up enough, or it's just a byproduct of low productivity. It's such a stark contrast to recent history that you wonder how it can be missed.
So the 1949 election in Australia, it was Chifley up against Robert Menzies. Menzies had a massive injection of foreign money into the campaign, pioneered cinema advertising in Australian politics. There was a long-running radio show promoting the Liberal Party's agenda that ran all through 1949. Chifley made those speeches about the light on the hill, and he talks about the vision that Labor has for the future. The centrepiece of Labor's campaign in 1949 was to preserve full employment under 2%. And in the process, he talked to accuse Menzies and the Liberals as they will abandon that. If you vote them in, they will abandon that. And they had the phrase, you'll be cool in Menzies' pool of unemployment. The Liberals countered by saying that was a scandalous accusation, that since the work of Lord Keynes and the experience everyone's had of the Second World War, we now know, all parties know how to maintain full employment. It's not something that's just a Labor preserve. We will maintain the full employment. Labor found a paper that had been done by this guy called Taulieff Hitton, who was a Tasmanian economist, who said that the unemployment rate should really come up to about 5 to 6%. Really, if you wanted to, you know, have good, sustainable economy. And So that's when Chifley and a few of his ministers went on the offensive and said that's what they're going to do. They're going to say they're going to preserve full employment, but redefine full employment as 6 to 8% of unemployment.
Mm.
Menzies had to come out in the 1949 election and explicitly say that he will keep unemployment under 2%, you know, denounced the Labor Party as, you know, scandalous muckrakers for suggesting it. Mind you, they were just reminding the public that in 1944, when they went and sought a referendum to get those wartime powers that end when a government's no longer fighting a war, they wanted to get an extension of those for, I think it was about 6 years after the war, so that they could bed the economy down and not have a repetition of the chaos that happened after the First World War. And Menzies resurrected his dead political career by championing the argument against it. And in Australia, unless you have bipartisan support for a constitutional, you know, referendum, it always goes down. It's such a high bar to get over. And then the issue about petrol rationing. So Britain had a currency crisis at the time, and the world petrol market, the oil market, was denominated in US dollars, so you had to get US dollars if you wanted to buy. And the Brits got the Commonwealth countries to pool all their American dollars so that they could collectively get the stuff from America that they needed for the post-war reconstruction. And it was a Labor government in Britain, so they had a bit of sympathy for them. And so Australia voluntarily agreed to ration petrol so that it wasn't using that many US dollars, so that the pool of Commonwealth countries would be able to get the necessities that were denominated in American dollars. Well, Menzies and the boys said, oh, well, that's just rampant socialism because there's no shortage of petrol. There's plenty of petrol in the world. We don't need to ration it. That's just socialist government overreach. And that swayed the day. Menzies saying, we will keep unemployment under 2% and we'll end the petrol rationing. And so Menzies won the 1949 election, and the Conservatives remained in power for 23 years after that.
Mm.
And Bill's often sort of tested me on this. He sort of said, so, okay, if Menzies was so opposed to it, how come we had the full employment all through that period?
Mm, that is the question.
And the truth of the situation is that every time the Conservatives tried to throttle back on public expenditure, even when it was actually necessary because the economy was overheating, the trade union movement and the Labor Party would come out in full force and say, they're pulling the pin on full employment. We told you they'd do it, and now they're doing it. And this forced the Menzies ministers to rush out and fiercely deny it, and they couldn't trim their expenditure. And when they tried to cool off the economy in 1961, I think unemployment went up to 3.5% or something like that, and they had an election, and Menzies won it by one seat. And there's the old joke that it was Jim Killen and they won it on Communist Party preferences. Mm-hmm. So if he had have been successful in banning the Communist Party,
he might have gone
down in that election.
So back to that article, 1943, Kolesky's writing, the fight of the progressive forces for full employment is at the same time a way of preventing the recurrence of fascism. Now, is full employment really that important?
In 1943, they were in the middle of a war against fascism.
Mm.
And the descent into fascism in Germany was largely a result of the desperate poverty and suffering of the German people who were bearing the weight of the post-war reparations that had been forced upon them largely by France and Britain. And our own Billy Hughes was a major cause of that. He was one of the most vociferous voices at Versailles conference demanding, you know, German reparations. I think that's what Kolesky's getting at. You know, given that we've got the capacity to avoid depressions and major recessions and things like that, if you want to avoid the descent into something like fascism, you need to look after your people and they need to be given some security. And I think writing in 1943, that's what he was pointing out, that had we done this in Britain and Germany and other countries, the slide into fascism probably wouldn't have happened if we had have had a reasonable standard of living for people. Because one of the things that Hitler did was, Kolesky talks about this in the article too, that the fascists were able to invest in the autobahns and massive public works, and they brought Germany close to full employment.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason they could do that was that the businesses had the Nazi party there to control the unions and the socialists.
They weren't afraid of full employment.
They weren't afraid of full employment because they had Hitler there. Mm-hmm. And that's the issue that Kolesky raises, that unemployment is maintained to maintain the discipline of the, it's often referred to as the master over man, or of the business owner over the employee, because of the fear of unemployment. If you take the fear of unemployment away, then the two are meeting each other on more equal grounds as people involved in an economic transaction. I will provide my labour power to your business and you'll provide me with remuneration out of the sale of the goods and services that we are both combining to produce. Now, in that situation, it's a bit more marginal how wealthy the owner of capital can become under that situation. But one of the things about full employment that's often neglected during that post-war period is that small businesses actually do very well out of it because of the buoyant demand and the stability in the economy.
Mm.
It was when you get the big recessions of the 80s and 90s in Australia that you see so many small businesses wiped out and large companies take this massive market share. And that's because they've got pockets deep enough to ride out the recessions.
Mm.
Whereas the family, you know, the corner shop that's not part of some large chain, they didn't. And so that's why you see this transformation in the business landscape in Australia that's happened since the abandonment of full employment.
I often think small businesses have more in common with the average employee or the average worker than they have with big business or corporations.
Well, if the local people have all got disposable income, you know, that's your source of your income.
I'm listening to this and I'm just seeing a repeat of the formula, you know, business and capital getting in there to interfere with any sort of progressive or socialist idea that might come to a government.
There used to be a very progressive weekly news magazine called the National Times that on the occasion of Robert Menzies' passing in 1978, they published a set of telexes on their front page, which were from Menzies and several industrialists and the head of J.B. Weir & Sons, who was a mate of Menzies, this guy called Staniforth Ricketson. And they were writing to this cabal of English financiers asking for them to fund a new political party in Australia because the previous Conservative Party had basically led Australia into the Depression, and they needed to throw the Labor Party out as quickly as possible because they're going to reflate the economy, essentially. And it was all over the front pages of the National Times, the actual text of these telexes.
You see this constant theme, and it runs completely contrary to the criticism that the Conservatives make, saying that the unions run Labor governments and the unions interfere with this and the unions interfere with that. When you look at the interference of the Conservative forces on successive Labor governments, they pale in comparison.
One of my feelings has been over the years that for most people, you sort of work on the basis that most of the people you deal with are quite sort of reasonable and decent, and they're upfront about, you know, what their aims are and things like that. And yeah, of course, there is deceitfulness, but as a sort of a general standard, you'd expect things to be pretty upfront and straight and whatever. But the more you go into the history of things, the more you go through the private papers of significant actors in business and in politics, the more you realise that there's actually quite a dark vein of ruthlessness. And I think one of the ways that they get away with it is because most of us, most of the time, give them more credit than we should.
You're on Radio MMT with Anne and Kev. We've been listening to an interview with Dr. Victor Quirk.
Friend of the show, Victor Quirk. And, you know, one of the things that I was learning there from our conversation with Victor, Kevin, was how there were Keynesians before there was Keynes.
Yeah, well, you know, we always hold Keynes in such high regard because he was kind of like this revolutionary thinker. But we're now learning that Kolesky, however you want to pronounce his name, and now
Ted Theodore.
You know, it was just independent thinkers who could see logic, you know.
Yeah, so it was even the returning soldiers after World War II were understanding how a government can have full employment, and the workers were understanding, and the politicians and the business class. So back then the battle was quite explicit. And then, as you were saying, these days the battle's been obscured a bit by these deficit and debt myth arguments. So, you know, keep an ear out when people are talking about the deficit, and usually happens around election time, because that is what obscures the fact that the government does have the capacity to create full employment.
Do you reckon the electorate was more switched on back then than they are now? Mm. You know, since the advent of the internet, we've got all this information to educate ourselves, and yet it seems that we're not as switched on as we used to be, that the public was...
Well, we haven't just come out of a war where they saw the government spending and having full employment. I think that helped a little bit. But it's so interesting too, shows up one of the great contradictions of capitalism. And it's this idea that on the one hand, you know, the businesses want to make money by selling us stuff, so they need consumers that have the money to buy the stuff. But then on the other hand, they want to maximise their profits by driving down wages. So they want to pay workers as little as possible. And then they seem to forget that the workers are the consumers. And so that if the workers can't afford to buy the stuff, you're not going to have enough demand in the economy.
I kind of get the impression that employers then and employers now probably know that if they pay their workers more, there's going to be more money in the economy for them to sell the stuff that they make, which would make them richer. However, they're prepared to forego some of that profit to maintain discipline over the workforce.
There you go. That was Kolesky's argument, yeah.
Yeah, it makes sense, doesn't it? They're filthy rich anyway. Like if we're talking about somebody who's just now worth $1 trillion.
Yes.
So if somebody has $1 trillion or $1 billion or is rich enough to be permanently comfortable, then you don't use your money to make yourself more comfortable. You use your money for power and influence.
Yes.
And so this is where they say, well, righty, okay, well, we're prepared to sacrifice some of our enormous profit just to make sure that the workers don't get too uppity and we'll keep them scared with unemployment.
Yeah. And so on top of that, they don't like the government being the consumer that can shore up the demand in the economy or the spending in the economy, because part of the power that they want is that ability to create recessions when they want the recession. Creating a recession means that you're driving up unemployment, getting the level of unemployment that they want. And in fact, that was another way in which Kolesky, he was so prescient back in the 1940s, and he predicted, and I'll quote from his article, he predicted that the war on full employment would look like, and I quote, opposition on principle to government spending based on a budget deficit. So he understood they would use the deficit myth.
He's probably the smartest person that I need to read more Kolesky. But you try and buy some Kolesky, it's always very expensive and hard to find.
Mm. So we will be airing the second half of our conversation with Victor in the next episode and going back into more of those pre-turn of the century struggles between workers and bosses. But in the meantime, Kevin...
Just one thing. You were saying before about they'll manufacture a recession, and it just gets me thinking, you know, like But when we're not talking about small business here, we're talking about big business, we're talking about big money, who can afford to ride through a recession. I reckon, just by the sounds of it, because we've been through a few economic cycles ourselves, and I've been in the event industry, and it's a very, very volatile industry, the event industry. And what happens is it goes up and it goes down. And every time it goes down, there's all these bargains to pick up. There's all these businesses which are collapsing and they're having fire sales, etc. If you've got enough money and you can manufacture a recession, you're basically creating conditions to go picking, to wipe out a lot of up-and-comers and just to clean out their stock.
I think that's another one of the dynamics, isn't it, is that that tendency towards monopoly in various sectors, and that's one of the reasons it happens.
You'll take a hit because it's going to, in the long term, it's going to benefit you. It's just
really makes me mad when I think about the people I know who've been affected by recessions. I know people who graduated in 1992 in the supposed recession we had to have, and their confidence in gaining work really took a hit. And you look back and you go, it wasn't your fault.
No, we're just all pawns in the whole thing.
We're pawns in this giant game.
So now, before we head to the Goldies Hotel this evening, Anne, to go and have MMT drinks with like-minded people, please come and join us because it's always nice to have new people down there. Goldies is in Collingwood.
And if you're wanting to know when the next pub night will be, just get onto the mailing list of publicmoneypublicgood.net and join the mailing list, and they'll let you know when the pub nights are coming up.
Yeah, excellent. Well, it was interesting hearing from Victor, and I really look forward to listening to the second half of that interview with him on our next show. He's good value. Yeah. Anyway, I think we should go to the pub and and see you again in a couple of weeks.
Let's do it. See you, Kevin. Later.
Bye.
You've been listening to Radio MMT with Anne and Kev.
We'd love your feedback. Email us on radiommt@gmail.com or search Radio MMT on social media.
Listen to this show anytime, wherever you get your podcasts, or on 3cr.org.au/radio MMT.
Support this show and the station by subscribing to 3cr.org.au and mention Radio MMT.
We thank all our guests.
And we thank economist Professor Bill Mitchell and his MMTed.org, educating the masses on modern monetary theory.
And thank you to our listening listeners for listening. And I thank you, Kevin.
And I thank you, Anne. So what's planned for next week?
Kevin, there is still so much to talk about. We've got to expose all this rotten economics.
Well, that's good, and I get it. Do you reckon we could use a bit more music?
Well, I made a list of all these terrible economic theories. Like, have you heard of the theory of comparative advantage, or the quantity theory of money, or the loanable funds theory?
Have you heard of a band called Single Gun Theory? Like, they're a really good band. I'm sure there's a whole range of, like, macroeconomic music that I could bring into the show.
Yeah, but we really need to do marginal productivity theory, not to mention the natural rate of unemployment and the money multiplier.
You've got a pretty good singing voice. I play bass. Bill, he plays guitar. I reckon we could form a macroeconomic band. Like, we could deliver this whole message by music.
Well, we could call the band the Permanent Income Hypothesis, or the Ricardian Equivalence, or Rational Expectations.
I think we're onto something here. We're trying to make macroeconomics more interesting to the masses. We're going to, like, form this band and sing it to them. And we're going to bring the economists in. We're going to get musical.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.